Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Lillian Faderman is a renowned historian known for her works on lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer struggles over the years. She's the author of a number of books on such topics, including her latest, The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle. She joins me here in the studio. Lillian Faderman, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you for having me, Mitch. Happy to be here.
And we're happy to have you. I want to begin by talking about terminology. And in fact, this is how you even begin your book, The Gay Revolution. And I was fascinated about the history of the word homosexual, a 19th century word that wasn't really used until the 20th century.
Right. And it was used to describe all of us who would call ourselves these days gay or lesbian or transgender or bisexual or queer. We were all homosexual as far as the outside world was concerned. And among ourselves from early in the 20th century, the underground term was gay, whether we were gay male or lesbian or transgender or queer. That was the preferred term that all of us used for ourselves.
When, how did the word homosexual get into use, and who brought that in?
It was actually Homosexualität, a German term that was coined in the 1860s. The sexologists who began writing about that time sometimes used that term, but also used the term even more frequently, sexual invert. Slowly, the term homosexuality filtered into the general population.
Well, was it considered derogatory to say sexual invert?
The medical doctors pretended at least that they were using it in a neutral way. But of course it was derogatory, because sexual inverts or homosexuals were always the other, always abnormal, and always people who were problematic in society as a whole.
Did, obviously, homosexuality has been around as long as people have been around. Has it always been persecuted the way it has, say, in the, I would say, what, last 70 years in this country?
In the modern era, male homosexuality generally was persecuted. It wasn't called homosexuality. Earlier, it was simply called sodomy, and it's not that people were homosexuals or heterosexuals, but rather men, quote, twisted their natural sexuality into abnormal sodomy, and that was indeed persecuted.
When we say modern history, how recent are we talking?
As far back, I would say, as the 16th or 17th century, okay, there's evidence of persecution of male sodomites. Women, as I've written about in other books, such as Surpassing the Love of Men, women who didn't have a masculine presentation, who didn't try to pass as male, could get away with a hell of a lot more. Passionate romantic relationships between women that we would now identify as middle class were often called romantic friendships. In the 19th century, they were called Boston marriages. They were socially acceptable because I think society as a whole didn't think about the sexual possibilities between women. On the other hand, women who presented as masculine, people who we would these days probably call transgender, were persecuted if their biological sex were discovered.
When I think of the persecution of homosexuals, I really think about the 1950s, an experience you know about personally. We'll talk about that in a moment. But before that period, what was there? I mean, the 1950s, it's commonly referred to as really a witch hunt, coupled in with communist and Wells being homosexual, oftentimes one and the same. We'll talk about that. But before that period, what was the persecution like? Was it as intense?
It wasn't for women, but if men were discovered to be having sex with men, that is, if they were sodomites, there was persecution, certainly.
Witch hunts, though? Were they actively?
No, and I was just going to make that distinction. Not the sorts of witch hunts that we witnessed in the mid-20th century, with a few exceptions. In 1919, for instance, it was discovered that there was a, quote, sodomy ring in the Navy, and there was a witch hunt of male homosexuals in the Navy when Franklin Delano Roosevelt, in fact, was the Secretary of the Navy. And surprisingly, he was the one who ordered that witch hunt. FDR did, yes. Astonishing, particularly since much later, about 1940, he was very protective of Sumner Wells, who had been in the State Department and was discovered to have been a homosexual.
But he protected Wells.
He protected Wells, but ultimately there were allegations against him, as I write about in the Gay Revolution. He tried to protect Wells, but finally Wells realized that to protect FDR, who had been a friend of his since childhood, what he had to do was resign, and he did resign from the State Department.
So this is in the 1940s.
That's right, yes.
Is he the first person that had to resign from a government post?
I believe he was. He's certainly the first person that I write about.
That we know about, who
felt that he needed to resign from a government post because of the pressure on him and the pressure on the president that he so loved.
Was there discussions about homosexuality during the 1930s and 40s that reached at a political level that FDR, beyond trying to protect Wells, would have to?
The discussion didn't reach a political level in the 1930s, but there was discussion. It happened particularly through the medical profession, who decided that homosexuality was a problem that needed curing, and they actually perverted what Freud said. Freud didn't believe that homosexuality could be, quote, cured, but
did Freud see it as normal?
It's not that he saw it precisely as normal. When he wrote about lesbianism, for instance, he saw it as a kind of arrested development, mm-hmm. but he didn't think it could be cured. He thought that women who were lesbians could be adjusted, but they could not be cured. But the psychotherapists, beginning in the 1930s, began to make a very good living by promoting cures for homosexuality. And I think their attitudes towards homosexuals filtered into the general population, and we became, in yet another way, pariahs.
Right. And another important part of this history that I want to get to as well in talking about it as a mental illness and the classification of it. But I don't want to lose sight of Wells yet, because who went after him and why?
Well, I think that Cordell Hull realized that Sumner Wells, Cordell Hull was the head of the State Department, and he realized that Sumner Wells was far more favored than he was. And so he cooperated with someone else in the State Department, William Bullitt, who had really hoped with Cordell Hull's retirement to be named Secretary of the State Department. And it became clear to Bullitt that FDR favored Sumner Wells. And what happened was that Tallulah Bankhead's father, who had been in Congress died in 1940, and many of the top government officials went to the South, where he was buried, to attend his funeral, including Sumner Wells. On the way back on the train at 4 o'clock in the morning, it was said that Sumner Wells called for the porter and propositioned him. And when the porter politely refused, Sumner Wells, who was drunk, they had been drinking all evening on the train, then called for another porter and propositioned him. This happened three times. J. Edgar Hoover got word of it and told FDR, and FDR said, well, stop him from doing it, but keep it quiet. It leaked to Cordell Hull and then leaked to William Bullitt, who really had a vendetta against Sumner Wells for the reasons that I had mentioned. And Bullitt went to see President Roosevelt and said, you have to get rid of him. You're thinking of entering a war where you're going to ask people to die for their country, and here you have this terrible sodomite in the State Department. And FDR refused to do it at that point. That was when Wells realized that there was great pressure on FDR, and he himself resigned. But by then, everyone in the State Department knew what had gone on. There was a young man working in the State Department at that time, the early 1940s, by the name of John Purifoy. Very ambitious. By the late 1940s, he was promoted to the undersecretary under Dean Acheson. And he also realized that he had a hot topic here. There was all sorts of paranoia, worried about communist infiltration. He would get rid of the Reds in the State Department, and he would also get rid of all of the homosexuals. And he remembered what a terrible stir was caused when Sumner Wells was accused of homosexuality in 1940. And he realized that this would eventually catapult him into the Secretary of State position, I think he thought. And so he began a witch hunt in the State Department of subversives and sexual perverts. And of course, homosexuals were drummed out of the State Department. They were eventually drummed out of all government employ, and it filtered down to non-governmental positions. Whether or not a homosexual was in a position that where he or she could possibly be a threat to the nation's security, nevertheless, that person was fired. In the private sector, companies emerged, such as one called Fidelifacts, that told employers that they would do background checks of employees and potential employees to see if that person had any homosexuality in his or her background. And of course, many people were fired that way. So at one point, it was very difficult for gays and lesbians and people who we would now call transgender or bisexual or queer, very difficult for them to find employment if they were in any way suspected of homosexuality.
I mean, this must be one of the most difficult periods of time.
It was
really
indeed.
I mean, we think how far we come now, but the thing is, not that long ago.
Yes. I actually came out as a teenager in 1956, and the way the term came out was used then was not to make public announcements, but to come out into the gay culture. And what I learned very quickly is that we were pariahs in every way. We were to the churches sinners.
After you came out, or did you know that?
No, I was a teenager. I was 16 years old, but it quickly became apparent from what my friends had suffered and what I started reading about because, of course, I read avidly to find out everything I could about being gay. So we were sinners to the church. We were subversives to the government. We were crazies to the medical profession, and we were criminals to the cops. And those attitudes, of course, filtered into the rest of society. So wherever we turned, we were outsiders and hated, and most of us knew that we had to be in the closet if we wanted to function in the world.
While you were at UCLA, you were forced to fill, and you and other people were forced to fill out questionnaires about whether you've had same-gender sexual experiences.
Yeah. This was my freshman year at UCLA. It was 1958, and we all had to take a battery of psychological tests. Scattered among the questions on the test were questions such as, are you attracted to members of the same sex, or have you ever kissed a person of the same sex? I knew to say no to everything, probably. Any gay student knew you had to say no. Maybe straight kids didn't know you had to say no because they didn't know what kind of persecution there was of homosexuals. But much later, when I was doing a book called Odd Girls and Twilight Lovers, I ran across an article that was published in 1954 in a journal called The School and Society. And it had been written by the dean of students. And his point in the article was that it was the responsibility of deans of students in universities all over the country to ferret out the homosexuals and either insist that the homosexual get psychiatric care and change into a heterosexual, or that person should be expelled from the university. And that was what those tests were about, that we freshman students had to take when we entered UCLA. And I'm sure many other colleges and universities as well.
So before the Sumner Wells affair in 1940, and then sort of, I guess that was the precursor to what was going to come. Well, we say that what was to come was really in the 1950s, or did it begin before then?
Things got bad even before then. I actually begin the book with a case that I discovered that hadn't been written about very much before, but this was a man who was a university professor at the University of Missouri. He that year, 1948, he was the acting dean of the School of Journalism. He was much loved, very successful.
E.K. Johnston,
yeah. Yes. He had a national reputation. It was really thought that when the regular dean retired, E.K. Johnston would be named the full-time dean of the College of Journalism. The man that he lived with, who was his friend, had been his lover, but who became his friend, was arrested and, as very often happened in the mid-20th century, made to name names. And he named E.K. Johnston. Johnston was pulled in, grilled. Word of his arrest was passed to the college of the president of the University of Missouri. He was immediately fired without a trial. It became just a huge scandal all over the Midwest. In fact, I write about various Midwestern newspapers that wrote about the arrest of E.K. Johnston. What happened was not just that Johnston himself was fired, but it triggered a witch hunt at the University of Missouri for other homosexual professors and homosexual students. And if somebody was discovered to be homosexual at the University of Missouri in 1948, they were tossed out. That kind of witch hunt spread all over the country. I write, for instance, about perhaps the most extensive witch hunt of homosexuals in education in Florida, actually funded by the Florida State Congress through a committee called the Florida Legislative Investigation Committee. They had started out trying to pressure African Americans, or Negroes as the preferred term was at that time, particularly the NAACP. There was, of course, after Brown versus the Board of Education, there was pressure on Florida to integrate the schools. They didn't want to. And so they tried to find communist infiltration in the NAACP. The NAACP fought back all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said that this Florida Legislative Committee had to stay off of the NAACP's back. So they decided they would find communist infiltration in state-funded universities in Florida. The American Association of University Professors fought back and said, you can't do this. You can't look at the reading lists of professors. The Florida committee tried to even scrutinize reading lists, and they said these professors are using these terrible books such as Grapes of Wrath just as proof that there was communist infiltration in the classroom. The American Association of University Professors was successful in fighting back. The Florida Legislative Investigation Committee had all of this money given them by the legislature. They had to do something about it. They discovered that in these state-funded universities in Florida, there were actually homosexuals on the faculty, and that began a huge homosexual witch hunt funded by the Florida legislature that went on for 8 years. And anyone who was suspected of homosexuality on the faculty or in the student body of these universities, they were tossed out.
Again, we are in conversation with renowned historian Lillian Foderman, author of a number of books about the history of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender movements. Her latest book, very big book, called The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle, recognizing, again, that the persecution of homosexuals goes back far before the 1940s. What do you think it was, though, that made what happened in the 1940s and the 1950s such a frenzy of activity towards persecution?
I think what happened in the 40s and 50s is that gay communities grew. And again, what I mean by gay is not only male homosexuals, but lesbians and transgender people and people who would call themselves queer these days. They grew because they very often were established in big cities. And this happened particularly during and after the war. Many people from small towns and rural areas moved to big cities to work in the defense industry. People who were in the military were often given R&R in big cities. When they left the military, having discovered that there was indeed an LGBT culture or a gay culture, as it was called,
community where people would hang out.
Right. They came back to those big cities, mm-hmm. and the communities grew. And I think that they were always underground communities, or almost always underground communities. And I'll talk about a couple of exceptions. But I think that once the community reared its head, even in the slightest way, it was discombobulating for heterosexual society to see these homosexuals who were congregating in groups, were making communities.
And what were those communities that weren't underground?
Well, 1950 was actually the beginning of homosexual organizing. It happened right here in California, in Los Angeles. Harry Hay began a group that he called the Mattachine Society. They wouldn't use the word homosexual for themselves because homosexual emphasized sexual, and what they wanted to say is that we're so much more complex than simply our sexuality. Right. So they used the term homophile. I should say that it was not the very first group that was organized in the United States. The very first one existed very briefly in 1924 in Chicago. It was founded by Henry Gerber. Within weeks, the police found out about it and arrested the man who organized it.
1924.
1924.
Okay, so you had such a group back
then. But very brief, a matter of weeks before it was broken up.
So it wasn't that the 20s were any more tolerant. It was just...
Oh, no. There were... little sections of tolerance like Greenwich Village, for example, in the 1920s. But for the most part, no, there was certainly no tolerance in the 1920s. But Harry Hay was the first to say we have to organize and define ourselves as an oppressed cultural minority. That was such an important concept to say that we were a group that needed to unify, and we were a minority. We were a cultural minority, and we were oppressed, and we had to fight our oppression. Also in San Francisco, in California, in San Francisco, in 1955, another group started, and that was Daughters of Bilitis, and it was a lesbian group started by four lesbian couples. Only two of them remained, but they made the group grow. Only two of the eight people remained, and that was Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon.
Legends here.
Yes, legends indeed in the San Francisco Bay Area, yes.
Tell me more about their influence, and you spent a lot of time in telling the history of the overall movement by including lesbian voices and the importance of including that maybe sometimes has, and there's a history of this, even a division between gay and lesbian, especially in the 1970s within the movement.
Yes.
Tell me about the importance of lesbians in this movement.
Daughters of Bilitis had started initially as a social group away from the bars because, as I discovered just a year or so later, the bars were very dangerous. The police could raid them. The lesbians who went to those bars could be, often were, arrested. I, of course, was a minor, so I knew I would be in big trouble if I were discovered in a bar. I was never arrested, but there was always that possibility. Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon and the other women that they started the Daughters of Bilitis with realized that lesbians needed to get together, needed some social outlet. The bars were dangerous. They would start a group. They would meet in people's houses. In the beginning, it wasn't at all intended to be political. The other women broke away, and Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon did try to make Daughters of Bilitis political. That was never their strong suit. I think the most important thing that Daughters of Bilitis did was start a magazine called The Ladder, and that began in 1956. And what was wonderful about The Ladder is that it circulated all over the country. It was passed from hand to hand. They didn't have a huge subscription list, but one woman would subscribe, and that would mean she would pass it on to 10 other women who would pass it on to then other women. One of the women that I interviewed for the book, just as an example of how far the ladder passed, was Robin Tyler, who told me that she was in Manitoba in Canada, really questioning her sexuality, knowing that she was different, not having a word for it. She went into this used bookstore and found an old issue of the ladder, and it made all the difference in her life. It not only gave her a word for who she was, but it gave her the realization that there were a lot of other women who were lesbians, and one of these days she could go to California and meet these women and live an open life. And that I'm sure happened repeatedly with the ladder. It happened all over the country.
It's funny when you mention the ladder and just the ability of people to be able to connect with one another. It just makes me think of my grandmother who told me that she used to like listening to this very radio station, KPFA, back in the 50s or 60s. I don't know exactly the time, but she said one of the things she told me surprised me at the time was, oh, yeah, they would announce gay and lesbian events. And I just thought that was really neat. And I liked hearing that. I mean, I'll have to inquire with her more about about that later at a later time. But the importance, though, of being able to connect and being able to.
Yes, and before people were able to connect, before there were communities, I think there was such a sense of isolation, outsiderness, and no understanding that we are, as Harry Hayes said, an oppressed cultural minority and needed to fight for our rights. And until we had that understanding, we were pariahs for all of society, but you know, particularly for the police and the government and the medical profession and everywhere we turned.
Mentioned earlier, there was a split within the movement between gays and lesbians. Were they united before the 70s? Did they?
Well, there were some attempts to unite gays and lesbians. I myself, and I don't think this was unusual, I married a gay man. We thought we would have what was called at that time a front marriage.
Not unusual at all.
We would pass as far as society would be concerned, and our sexual and emotional relationships would be with people of the same sex. And I think that happened very often. Gay men and lesbians needed each other for that. Even as a teenager, I can remember going to office parties with my gay male friends so that they could pass at work. And that happened very, very often.
If you didn't show up with them at the party, then people would be suspicious?
Yes, of course. Yes, yes. Why would a young man, presumably an eligible bachelor, not have a girlfriend? Yeah. So I was the girlfriend for many of my gay male friends, and I know that happened frequently.
So tell me about the split in the 1970s.
Well, things weren't always great between gay men and lesbians, even when we desperately needed each other to pass. Del Martin, for instance, was very upset when San Francisco Mattachine suggested that Daughters of Bilitis and Mattachine merge. At one point, Mattachine gave her and Phyllis Lyon an award at a banquet, and I think the people who were present really thought that they would accept their award and say nice things about how Mattachine and DOB should work together. And instead, Del Martin delivered this angry speech. This was in 1959, an angry speech about how male homosexuals talk about homosexuality and try to fit female homosexuals into the paradigm that describes them. And she said, we are different. We are women. We don't go cruising in parks, for instance. She was very upset about that paradigm that seemed to cover both, and yet she knew that lesbians had very different kinds of lives than male homosexuals did. So that was just one statement of how we are different. But of course, Del Martin was a huge leader among lesbians, and I think she brought that statement to many other lesbians as well. But what happened is that as a result of the feminist movement that started in the 1960s, lesbians began to realize, and Del Martin articulated this also in the pages of the latter, and those who followed her continued to articulate it, that lesbians not only had the problems of homosexuals, they had the same problems that women had. And they began to say that gay men were as suspect, as male chauvinist, as straight men. And so lesbians had to organize on their own. This was particularly true of lesbian feminists and radical lesbian feminists. And so for much of the 1970s, there was a huge split in the movement between lesbians and gay men.
And also lesbians, though, also found it difficult to be accepted by the feminist movement.
Yes, so lesbians really had it from both sides. Mm-hmm. Betty Friedan, who was the founder of the National Organization for Women, the largest feminist organization in the country, accused lesbians of being the lavender menace in the women's movement. And what she meant by that is that because they were in the women's movement, society would say that's what feminism was all about. It was just a bunch of lesbians getting together because they hated men. And so she felt very threatened by lesbians and the women's movement. So another reason why lesbians had to break away from, first of all, the gay movement and then the feminist movement and start their own movement, and they did as lesbian feminists. But an interesting point here is, I think when huge problems emerged from the outside, lesbians and gay men, even in the 1970s, managed to work together. And perhaps the best example of this was with the Briggs Initiative in 1978. John Briggs, inspired by a Florida crazy, Anita Bryant, who started the Save Our Children campaign and was managing to repeal gay rights ordinances all over the country.
Gay right ordinances are being enacted.
Yes, they're
to repeal.
By the time Anita Bryant got on the scene, which was 1977, and with Save Our Children, there were 40 cities that had already had gay rights ordinances. And what stimulated her is that she lived in Miami, and the Dade Miami Board of Commissioners had just added to a non-discrimination ordinance that covered people of color and women and people with disabilities, had just added the term sexual and affectional preference. That is gay people. And Anita Bryant led this campaign for a referendum that repealed that initiative, ordinance in Dade County, Florida, and then led other campaigns in places like St. Paul, Minnesota, and Wichita, Kansas, and she inspired a campaign in Eugene, Oregon. They all repealed their ordinances. John Briggs, a California senator, thought that he would like to run for governor, and here was a great issue. This was a hot topic.
It always gets wrapped up into politics this way when somebody finds their...
Yes, right.
You see it today with Donald Trump in immigration.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. And so he got Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative, to qualify for the California ballot. That was a little different from Anita Bryant's city ordinances that she repealed. This would have been even bigger. It would have been statewide, all over California. And what Prop 6 said was that anyone who was a homosexual could not teach in the public schools. But not only was it homosexuals that would be fired from the public schools, anyone who said anything nice about homosexuals would be fired from the public schools. That is, you couldn't express any kind of sympathy or support for homosexuality. It really looked, according to polls, as though the Briggs Initiative would pass. And of course, there was all of this momentum of these ordinances that had been repealed in cities around the country. Finally, gay men and lesbians managed to get together. The North and the South of California managed to get together. People of all stripes of political ideology managed to get together in California, and they really waged a fantastic campaign against the Briggs Initiative, and they won. The Briggs Initiative did not pass.
Is this one of the first major electoral victories for gay, lesbian communities?
I think it was a major statewide, first major statewide victory. There had been victories in cities, but of course, all of those ordinances would have been threatened if a state as liberal and as big as California had passed the Briggs Initiative. So it was vital in all sorts of ways. Another thing that I think that it really did. In fact, I call the section of the book in which I talk about the Briggs Initiative, How Anita Bryant Advanced the Movement for Civil Rights, for LGBT civil rights. She did it because she made us realize that we either had to hang together or we would all hang separately.
Like the ban on marriage, maybe, in a way.
Yeah,
or at least
sure.
In the dynamic, you're under attack, so now...
Right, yes.
You brought the issue forward.
Yes. So I think we learned a lot about organizing from that, and then we forgot it again with Prop 8. But I hope we've remembered it, that we have to hang together. That if we're going to work on a political issue, we can't have dissensions. We all have to pull together.
So you get this rapprochement between gays and lesbians, at least politically, actively, in 1978. To the Briggs Initiative, and then you get this real coming together in the 1980s, which I think is an absolute beautiful story, though in a very tragic period, and that's with the onset of HIV/AIDS, largely affecting gay males, and now this is when women and lesbians...
Yes, AIDS was by far the worst devastation that the community had ever experienced. But surprisingly, something good came out of that devastation, and that is that the community nationwide really learned how to organize, how to fight together. All factions of the community learned how to fight, and it's sad that it took something like the devastation of AIDS to heal the rift that had continued essentially between gay men and lesbians. But I think we came together hugely to fight against the disease. Lesbians, for instance, opened food banks all over the country. One of the few professions open to middle-class women for years had been nursing. And of course, there were many lesbian nurses who knew how to navigate the medical system. And I think they were very helpful to gay men. I think there was an understanding that not just among lesbians and gay men, but gay people in general, that there was no place in the closet when there was such a devastation. So more and more people began to come out, not only those who were outed by the disease, but their friends, their supporters, who said that we have to fight against this disease. We have to fight, for instance, for government funding to find a cure for this disease. And so the exit from the closet was terrific in the 1980s.
Also, leadership roles opened up.
Yes.
For women in,
yes,
in the movement.
Yes. Before that, there were very few women leaders of national organizations. With the advent of AIDS, when so much of the leadership gay men had been sickened, and many of them had been killed by the disease. There were a number of women who began to lead these national organizations, and even things like in Los Angeles, for instance, there's the biggest LGBT center in the country. It was founded, actually the first LGBT center founded at the very beginning of the 1970s. It had always been led by men. In the 1980s, the head of the LGBT center was a woman, and it's been led by women ever since, because I think it was realized finally that, yes, women could do a good job at an executive position, and women were then hired to lead the center. Always since the 1980s.
Lillian Fetterman, as we move to wrap up, when you were talking about the dynamic in the 1970s and the split between gay and lesbians saying, well, we're women, we're also feminist, and we have these other things, and, you know, patriarchy exists amongst the gay community. It reminded me of what we have today, I would say, in the overall movement, where you now have gays and lesbians and queers and transgendered bisexuals of color, or immigration, or you have people saying, you have some people saying, well, marriage is what we want. Others saying, that's heteronormative. Yeah. That's not what we want. I mean, do you see parallels to that?
I do, and the parallels go back long before that, from the very beginning. Harry Hay, who started that first ongoing homophile organization, Mattachine, had been a communist. He actually quit the party when he started Mattachine, because he was afraid that if there was persecution of homosexuals and he was a communist, it would move over into more persecution of the Communist Party. So he quit the party. The organization began to grow, and people who were not communists began to join the organization. And when they realized that the leadership, and it wasn't only Harry Hay, it was all five of the founding members had been members of the Communist Party as well, when they realized that the leadership had a communist background, and in the early 1950s, they panicked and they kicked the five founding members of Mattachine out of Mattachine. And so it became a very different kind of assimilationist organization. But it was ever thus, or continued to be ever thus. After the Stonewall Riots in 1969, an organization was formed called the Gay Liberation Front. The Gay Liberation Front was very radical, thought that the gay cause was very closely aligned with the cause of all other persecuted minorities, wanted to fight, for instance, for the Black Panthers, gave all of the money that they earned through their dances to Black Panther causes and Young Lord causes. Young Lords, it was a Puerto Rican group in New York. Some people within the Gay Liberation Front said, wait a minute, what about gay causes? It's not that we're not sympathetic to the Black Panthers and the Young Lords, but we joined this group because we wanted to fight for gay causes. They quit the Gay Liberation Front and they started the Gay Activist Alliance. The Gay Activist Alliance was going to concentrate just on gay causes. It kind of ballooned from there. Some members of the Gay Activist Alliance thought that the Gay Activist Alliance was too radical, and they wanted other kinds of rights that the Gay Activist Alliance wasn't focusing on. And so Bruce Moeller quit the Gay Activist Alliance and started the National Gay Task Force. And they would do things like fight the media representation of gay people all over the country. So there's always been this kind of dissension within the LGBT community. What we have in common always, I think, is a common enemy. The radical right doesn't give a damn if we're queer or lesbian or gay or transgender. They would like to kill us all, get rid of us all in one way or another. So I think we come together in the face of a common enemy, but we are and always have been extremely diverse.
It seems like that common enemy is on its heels right now in this fight. Do you ever worry, and not that the fight's over, but do you ever worry it could rise and be?
Well, I don't think they've given up. I think they're going to continue to fight. I think Kim Davis in Kentucky, the county clerk that wouldn't marry same-sex couples, was only the tip of the iceberg. I think they're going to be there. And you know, just one example, the latest declaration by the Mormon Church that children of same-sex couples couldn't even be recognized by the church. Innocent children, not to mention innocent same-sex couples, but they couldn't be recognized by the church. So the right will not give up, and we can't give up. I think our fight is into perpetuity.
Is the fight beyond marriage?
Oh, yes.
What about the critique about now that we have marriage? We have marriage and military. It's over.
We have marriage and the military for now, but I don't think it's by any means over. I think it's very important that we vote the right way in the next election. It would be frightening to think of what would happen if a right-wing president appointed Supreme Court justices, as will certainly happen if we don't.
But there are gay conservatives.
Yes, of course there are. But I think that the Supreme Court could easily, with justices to vote in favor of overthrowing same-sex marriage, that could easily happen, that so many of our rights could easily be taken away again.
Lillian Fetterman, I've enjoyed our conversation very much. Thank you for being
too.
Here.
I have too. Thank you, Mitch.
Again, Lillian Fetterman has been our guest. The name of her book, The Gay Revolution, The Story of the Struggle.